Mr. Brooks, you'll be pleased to know that over the break I've reflected on the trauma to all of us if I trace you through the rules one by one to check your understanding. So instead I'm just going to ask some high-level questions to finish up, if I may. So from a farm systems perspective, do you agree that it's better to assess all of the farming activity on a property as a whole?
Those activities interact with each other and they're not separate, it is beneficial because then you can look at how those interactions could influence risk.
Even when they don't interact, is there not also benefit in terms of identifying the most appropriate places on a particular property for a particular activity, or places on a property that may be better retired or revegetated or changed in land use?
Appropriate land use according to capability is a good way of being able to reduce risk. Whether that matrix of farming land, a parcel of land in separate enterprises and they don't interact, I think ultimately they will interact because of the positioning of a paddock. That you at some point you will use that for a different enterprise, even though you were setting it for a certain enterprise, just because situations change and you'll make different decisions about where you're going to put a crop according to the circumstances of the day, which means that generally they would interact together unless they're being run separately. So you know, you've got hill country at the back of the farm, which could be dry stock. You've got the lower land, which would be a dairy, more dairy, and with some rolling. And then, if you had an arable operation, could be separate. So, but if they were all intertwined, being farmed paddock next door to each other and then changing again, that would be, you know, that would be a very complex situation where something to class them as one would probably be easier.
And so from your perspective, what's the need for having that level of interaction in order to consider the entire property as a whole?
If those three, say for example, three different enterprises influence each other, they will influence risk. So the need to look at them together, I think, is really important. But if they're totally run as separate enterprises, you could judge them separately in terms of a farm environment plan, in terms of how you assess a risk, whether it be a scorecard, whether it be a stocking rate, or whether it be a set of rules, or a set of rules to determine what the consenting regime is.
And so importantly, you said there that you could do it that way, so it's about maintaining the flexibility from your perspective.
You need to have a mechanism that would allow you to do it that way, and at the moment, because there isn't overseer, I don't believe there's a mechanism to allow you to assess them all together.
If you're not using overseer.
Yeah, it would be very difficult because you can't directly compare a nitrogen risk scorecard to a cropping scorecard to a dairy's dry stock drafting gauge because there's not been the work done that compares those directly. They're all in isolation of each other.
Thank you, that's very helpful. I've got no further questions, Your Honour. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Crowley.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, Mr. Rockstock. Do you have the post-conferencing version of Panchain Crime here?
Yes.
Thank you. So, when we're looking at a tool, and we've talked about the overseer tool, the nitrogen, Fonterra nitrogen risk scorecard, there are two uses for these tools in the plan change. One, which we've talked about, is the drafting gate. And if we look at policy 1D there, page 15. That refers to ensuring the activity status for farming relates to the risk of diffuse discharge of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and microbial pathogens to water bodies. So the activity status is supposed to be related to the risk of diffuse discharges of those four contaminants. And the tool, the Fonterra risk tool, when it looks at nitrogen alone, is intended to be a proxy for the risk of those other three contaminants?
Yes.
And then if we go down to the second use of the tool, it is what needs to be achieved once you get through the gateway. And if we look at policy 2, policy 2C, Roman numeral 1, it states, reduce the risk to moderate or low, as set out in Schedule B, Table 1, and Schedule B, Table 1, is the nitrogen, Fonterra nitrogen risk scorecard calculation. So, is that your understanding that those are the two purposes of the tool. And two primary purposes from a regulatory or rule perspective.
Yes.
So if we look at what fit for purpose means in relation to this tool, and if we look at policy 1D, that gives us a guide here. It's the risk of diffuse discharges. It's the purpose that we're trying to achieve. And in your view, is Overseer a far more superior tool for that purpose than the Fonterra Nitrogen Risk Scorecard?
Overseer, with its background and its science, has a better ability to model complex systems. It also includes the ability to take into account the inherent risk, so slope, contour, rainfall, etc. So in terms of that, it would. It's down, like every other model, its downside is primarily it revolves around around nitrogen. So it still doesn't cover substantially, even though there's a phosphate output, it doesn't cover the other contaminants, and we haven't got a model that covers all four contaminants, unfortunately.
So if it were used, it would also have to be a proxy, whether you consider it a good proxy or a poor proxy, it would also be a proxy for the risk of those other three contaminants.
Yes.
But if we just look at nitrogen, it is a far more superior tool for assessing the risk of diffuse discharge of nitrogen than the Fonterra Nitrogen Risk Scorecard, isn't it?
In the fact that it takes into account those inherent risks. So where it has been questioned through the papers, maybe MFE work, is whether it can be used in this framework. But in terms of my use of Overseer, I find Overseer very good. But like any tool, whether it be a soil test, whether it be Overseer, for me it's the trend of direction rather than the actual number. And that's where it's difficult when we use Overseer to judge someone at an actual number rather than the trend of direction.
That's all very well, but for the purpose of a consent gateway, we're going to need an actual number,
yep,
aren't we?
Yep.
And the reason it's, and you've touched on this, but I just wanted to clarify, the reason it's a more superior tool for the risk of diffuse discharge of nitrogen to waterways is because that issue in itself is multi-dimensional. It is not only the management practices or the inputs on the land, it relates also to rainfall, the soil profiles, and it's also temporal. If you then look at the risk to the actual waterway, you're looking at an attenuation issue as well, aren't you?
Yeah.
But yes. Overseer doesn't do that last one.
No. Overseer gives an indication of risk to the edge of the soil profile or the growing medium of the farm, so the boundary and below the root zone. After that, obviously there's attenuation and other factors that could influence, does that risk get to the water course or when does it get there?
And for some properties, for the climate and the soils, contributing to that risk could be a very high contributing factor compared to the good management practices and inputs factor. We're calling the climate and the soils factor, if I can call that inherent risk, that can be a very large factor for the overall risk, can't it?
Yes.
And to assess that risk, you need a model.
To assess that risk, to put a value to it, yes, you could assess some of those risks through a farm environment plan, but it won't put their value to that risk.
Is the, would you call the Fonterra Nitrogen Risk Scorecard a model?
No.
So the use of the nitrogen, Fonterra Nitrogen Risk Scorecard, instead of Overseer as a consent gateway, is going to mean that we have a different cohort of farms in permitted, controlled and discretionary categories, isn't it?
You may. You, that work could be done to actually assess those same overseer files for against their output for the nitrogen risk scorecard to see how much it changes. So you would probably see a change in the individual farmer who goes, the ones that are on the edge would change, but generally obviously the total number would stay the same.
Because it's the percentile.
Yeah. When I was at Dairy NZ, we looked at overseer files for the Upper Waikato because there was concern of the difference between how many farmers would be in certain percentiles according to whether we looked at FMU level and subcatchment level, and it actually didn't make too much difference because there was a concern from that can disadvantage some people over others. But it's the one round, the ones around the edges, rather than the core of the farmers that it would influence. But it would.
And at least one of the farmers giving evidence at this hearing, Mr. Colin Guyton, has given evidence that in the Reparoa area, there was concern that the use of overseer could penalise people or farmers in that area because they had tended to be on pumice soils and have heavier rainfall and therefore higher drainage compared with farms at the Karapiro end of the Upper Waikato FMU. So the 75th percentile approach could unfairly target them. Have you read that evidence?
Yes, and so my recollection of the PC1 process is when those percentiles were initially developed using the nitrogen loss rate, NLLR, each FMU had different numbers to take that into account. So the number, overseer number for the 25th and the 75th percentile for Upper Waikato was going to be different to the lower Waikato, to take into account that there was different inherent risk.
Right. Now, can you turn to paragraph 50 of your evidence sheet? So and you state there that in your view, for any gateway process, farmers and landowners need to see that the process is robust, fair and equitable, as we are likely to find land holdings on the same road with similar soils, climatic conditions and contour, i.e. inherent risks, but a different enterprise or farm system. Can you set out what you mean by that?
In some catchments, you will have a road and the first farm will be a dairy farm, the second farm will be a dry stock farm, the third farm will be a dairy farmer. So they have got similar inherent risks. Their farms will be all individual. But each of those farmers will need to be able to look over to the fence and say, hey, I'm pulling my weight on this. It's next door pulling their weight as well. So are we all being treated fairly? Doesn't mean that they've all got to implement the same actions because that's very specific to their own farm. But if I take back to the anecdotal evidence of talking to farmers in the Sustainable Dairy and Water Accord, when for a large period there was little expectation on a dry stock farmer to put a fence in, but a farmer supply expectation to put a fence in on theirs, that created a lot of angst within the community, that one farmer was looking over the fence on the other farmer and saying, well, why am I doing this and they're not doing the same? Because to exclude stock, you need a fence on both sides of the waterway. And I'm not saying whether that situation was right or wrong, but it creates angst within the community because everybody wants to make sure everyone else is doing their bit.
With fairness and equity, though, there is an issue, isn't there, about whether a farmer on leafy soils and with high climate may need to do more management practices given the inherent risk factors versus a farmer, say, in the Karapiro end of the same FMU, the Upper Waikato FMU. That is a fairness and equity issue at play here, isn't it?
Yeah, there needs to be, there's that fairness and equity in your local community, but also that fairness and equity as you go out to the wider FMU, as you go out to the whole catchment. So, yeah, there needs to be, people need to be seen that it works across, that fairness and equity works across the whole catchment and not across the whole plan change.
Both from the perspective of the good management practices, but also the inherent risk factor.
Yeah.
Do you have a view on that question?
It's because we're dealing with, as you say, inherent risk that are different in every farm situation, it's very difficult to determine what is enough on one farm compared to what is enough on another farm. Because often the actions that we're putting in cannot be measured. I always describe it, you spray a paddock out with Roundup and in 7 to 12 days time it goes yellow, so you know you've had value for money. But you can invest $300,000 in an effluent system or moving your races, and how do we know that we've had value for money? It's very difficult. So it's very difficult to compare on farm to say, well, farmer X has done X, has done one thing, farmer Y has done something else. So are they both, is that fair and equitable as to what they've actually achieved?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Now, turning to the issue which, as a farm system analyst, you perhaps prefer discussing, which is to look at trends on a farm rather than an absolute number in the regulatory context. Overseer gathers information, unlike the Fonterra Nitrogen Risk Scorecard, regarding phosphorus outputs on a per hectare end at a farm level, doesn't it? And to do that, it looks at four categories of slope and other issues, including the Olsen P score. And for that trend analysis, would you consider that it's essential for the council to have Overseer files, and in the decisions version it was called a nitrogen reference point analysis, in order to assess trends?
If Overseer was to be used, they would not need the files, they would just need certain data out of that files, because it would be the output. People completing Overseer files are certified nutrient management advisors, so there needs to be an assumption that the practices that are being implemented to get that file is robust, and that they have the right practices to collect the data. So really what the council would need in that instance for Overseer would be the output data that they would need to look at, to see what the trend is.
Mm. And Ms. Carruthers discussed with you this in relation to the end surplus number. I'm sorry, I've lost the correct title of that, but with the overseer output that you're talking about, that would provide more useful data for a trend analysis than a Fonterra Nitrogen Risk Scorecard aggregate score.
Yes.
Thank you. Ms. Ma, who's the fanner for Fish and Game, has proposed in Schedule B that Schedule B contains all the tools, if there are going to be more than one, for the gateway. And at the moment we've got the dry stocking rate tool and the dry stocking rate and the nitrogen leaching Fonterra tool. She's proposing they be moved into a schedule, which is easier to change if it needs to be changed later, rather than be contained in the rules. And she's also proposing that schedule states that the methods to assess the risks of diffuse discharges of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and microbial pathogens for farming activities in the schedule are proxies only. They do not accurately reflect the actual risk of the discharge, those contaminants entering water. They do not account for all contaminants or all pathways of contaminants. And then she's suggesting that it also state they're intended to be short-term proxies until they are replaced by a more accurate methodology as part of any freshwater plan change required to give effect to the NPSFN. Now, apart from the last sentence, which is perhaps outside your expertise, and if you want to, you can refer to this, but is that generally your understanding of what these tools are?
My understanding of the tools is that the tools allow us to ascertain level of risk, to be able to assign a level of oversight on a farming situation, and then to provide, as a result, then that provides a landowner with the guidance he needs, the conditions or the parameters he needs to work to. So whether that be a schedule, a permitted activity, or a controlled consent.
Now, you may not have turned to this, but this turned your mind to this, but this is my final question, and if it's another regional council expert, just let me know. But if such a statement were contained in the plan, would you see a problem with communicating that clearly to farmers? That it's a proxy, it doesn't cover the actual risk, and it's short term and it may be changed in the future?
It's a conversation that we need to have with all farmers, because that's the reality of where we're at.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rockstock.
Thank you. Mr. Mead. Sorry, Ms. Ford.
Good morning, Your Honour. It's Ms. Buxeda. Sorry, we're playing rotation as solicitors.
Very good.
We have no questions for the witness. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Ferguson?
Just briefly, sir.
Thank you.
Just following on from some questions that my friend. Freedom was on, we asked you, and we're talking about overseer and other scorecard options in that regard. Now, I don't want to delve into great detail in relation to that, but my understanding of some of the fundamental concerns with overseer that were identified in the peer review that was carried out related to, not that it didn't produce data, but there were fundamental issues regarding the accuracy and precision of that data, as I understood. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And I'm no mathematician and never wish to be one, but I understand that what sits behind some of that is actually the nature of the calculations that overseer is trying to do, and there's a tension or a shortcoming in terms of they're largely algebraic in nature. They add things up rather than a calculus-based formula that deals with rates that we're trying to grapple with. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes.
And there is active work ongoing in terms of trying to develop a suitable calculus-based modelling tool for that purpose. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And so I think just building on that point that my friend raised, regardless of what is used as a proxy or a gateway or a combination of tools, whether it's overseer, parts of overseer, or a scorecard, you would agree, wouldn't you, that what we need to do very quickly is to develop, test, and agree upon a new appropriate model that can then be introduced into PC1 in the future. That's clearly the line of travel that everybody's accepting, aren't they?
Yeah, and you know, as we've said, the most models use overseer as the proxy, and we recognise that there's four contaminants, so the development of models that allow us to better reflect what we're trying to manage would be obviously beneficial.
And so, given that I think, broadly speaking, there's a consensus, I won't put everybody into that consensus, that it's really important to get PC1 up and operational, we all have to acknowledge that there are some aspects that are still going to require ongoing work and refinement and review, and we can expect material changes, and modelling is one of those that could result in material changes in the near future.
Yes. To provide an example there, the last couple of years I've been completing the second stage of freshwater farm plans for the Tookie catchment, and when I'm looking at the fans, I go, these are a bit light. But when I get out on the farm and talk to the farmer, because they've been in that process, they've completed those actions, and when you go around the farm to update the fan, most of the actions that you see they've already completed, and it's because they've been on a process of development and engagement and knowledge, not necessarily having a plan that's got every single action up front that I need to do, which they get overwhelmed with, get on the journey, and improve as we go. I think that's really important.
Thank you, that was all I had, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. Mr. Majuri's not here. Mr. Pennell, are you present? No? Is there anyone else who has any questions for Mr. Proxon?
Sorry, Your Honour, I am here. Just doing something else on the side.
Right. Do you have any questions for this witness?
I do. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Proxon, can we go back to the 18 site units per hectare? Paddock stocking rate for stock exclusion. I guess this probably I'd rate this as the number one concern amongst farmers and the impact it has on the ability to rotationally graze. My first question really is, what is the problem council is trying to solve with this? At a high level, can I just run past this scenario of rotational grazing. Let's think of one mob of stock rotating daily around a rotation over a period of 20 days. I acknowledge in the day that the stock are in that paddock, there's potential of greater risk. But then for the other 19 days, there's no risk from that stock. So really, I see at a high level, there's no difference between rotational graze and stock, set stocking. So with that context, can you help put your finger on the issue that is trying to be solved by this condition?
So as I see it, the intent of the winter stocking rate rule was to try as a kind of proxy to indicate risk that could be applied without a formal assessment of an individual paddock. So he gave somebody to a starting point to say, you know, the likelihood as the number of animals in a paddock for a period of time are in there, there's more likelihood that they may seek to go to the waterway. But there's just so many factors that influence the likelihood of an animal to actually go to that waterway. Have I got access to water? Have I got access to shade and shelter? Can I actually get down to the waterway? All those factors can only be completed by an on-farm assessment. But so without going and assessing every individual situation for every individual farm, it's very difficult to ascertain what that risk is. So the aim of this was to put some form of line in the sand, and I think every expert witness at the joint witnessing agreed that 18 was too low, but there was no consensus as to what was appropriate.
So would you agree that this being in Schedule C, a minimum standard, that it should really provide some protection to the environment under all circumstances?
So Schedule C, all farms would need to adhere to Schedule C?
Yes. The concept of a minimum standard is something that should, in my view, be broadly applicable under all cases to do something positive for the environment.
Yes.
Okay. It seems to me from trying to gather, identify, and you still haven't put your finger on the real issues that it's trying to deal with, but seems from various councils' evidence that there's perhaps a concern about overgrazing as a result of rotational grazing. Would that be an issue?
No, for me the aim is, the concern is, animals directly standing in a waterway and urinating or defecating, and the damage that they would potentially do getting down to that waterway.
Okay. Look, in my experience, and that was the reason I started the way I did with riparian fencing, is I had an area of waterway on a soft alluvial country with steep banks that were very vulnerable to cattle treading. And the way I used to manage that before riparian fencing is to not overgraze, to move cattle on before they, so that they only graze the more palatable grass, and before they pushed into the stream and on the stream banks and into the stream to forage stream bank vegetation. So I can acknowledge there's an issue there, but I'll put it to you that this rule would not manage that situation. Take, for instance, a farm that isn't capable of set stocking at making stock units per hectare. That is, or a paddock, in that capability. That paddock is still, with your rule, quite capable of being overgrown. Would you agree with that?
So overgrazing is a farm management decision, so that's for the farmer to decide when he puts his stock in there and when he takes them out according to the opening cover, and then the residual cover he wants to have will indicate how many days or how much time or meter squared he needs to provide an animal. So that risk of overgrazing is a management issue.
Yeah. If you, as a certifier, thought that overgrazing was more than a management issue, but an issue for the farm environment plan, would you consider putting some management issue into the action plan of the farm environment plan, whether it be overgrazing or something else, to deal with the situation?
If it was agreed that that was an appropriate measure that would reduce risk, and that action could be written as a smart action, can't see why not. Actions written can be according to changing management activity or an investment in infrastructure, so that could be written into a plan that was farmer agreed, because it may be the reason that that farmer is overgrazing is his knowledge, and he needs help in upskilling. So there's no reason why that couldn't be an action.
Just going back to your earlier response, that if I can sum up that way, and spot unit per hectare is to cover a multiple of sins. Would those sins not better be addressed in a tailored way in the farm environment plan?
Can you just repeat the question, please?
If I can interpret your earlier response, that the agent stock unit per hectare condition is there to cover multiple sins, and that you couldn't actually put your finger on any one or a number of issues that would result from that, wouldn't those issues, those multiple sins, be better covered by tailored actions in the farm environment plan?
So it still comes down to the risk. So the actions that would be in the plan would be in relation to the assessed risk of, in that case, if a farmer had gone over the 18 stock units, as to what would be the appropriate action to make sure we manage that risk. And the primary risk that I see is that the direct stock access, and then as a result of maybe which one action could be fencing. Obviously, that could be other actions if they go down a different regulatory route, but then they can consider other things in discussion with the certified farm planner.
Okay, do you really need that trigger of 18 stock units per hectare to make that assessment? Wouldn't you be making that assessment and going through the requirements of the farm regulations, looking at risks and vulnerabilities and coming up with actions?
onset of freshwater farm plans, as you rightly say, a large number of farmers will now need to have an on-farm assessment by default, but there will still be a proportion, probably a small proportion of farmers that could be a permitted activity and don't need a farm environment plan. So if we were not to have that a stock unit or a measure to help, something else would need to be put in place to help those people, those landowners. So.
Yeah. That only applies to 20, less than 20 hectare properties, does it not?
Yes, in the rules.
Thank you. Do you accept that rotational grazing allows more proactive management than set stocking? Can I give you a couple of examples? During wet weather, rotations can be sped up to reduce pugging and risk of contaminants entering water.
Yes.
Mods can be moved on before overgrazing occurs, which increases the risk of treating damage of soft alluvial spring banks. Okay, right, I'll move away from this topic to a couple of others. Yesterday you, in response to talking about the capability issues around the large lengths of riparian fence required, prioritise streams determined by the National Stock Exclusion Regulations over PC1 streams. I totally agree that there are major capability issues involved here. So would it be useful to provide some other priorities, such as would it in your view, the more productive, greater immediate environmental benefits if the perennial streams were prioritised ahead of the intermittent ones? Given that the intermittent streams cannot transport contaminants unless there's flowing water.
That would be logical. The other thing that I think we will consider as we move forward into freshwater farm plans is that giving consideration to CCCV, the aim of that is that we will prioritise actions in the farm environment plan, firstly according to regulatory requirements, and then secondly according to CCCV considerations. So we're probably going to find that the order of fencing will be prioritised according to that as we complete freshwater farm plans, which PC1 will, part of this will be part of that if we can merge them together adequately.
Thank you, Mr. Watford. That's the end of my questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fennell. Nothing else? Any re-examination, Mr. Fisher?
No, thank you, sir.
Good afternoon. I'm interested in a sort of an overall broad opinion that you might have on overseeder and its use in PC1 for the purposes of, PC1 has got a short life. And we've heard that there are now concerns about overseeder and there's the nitrogen risk scorecard, which might be an effective tool to use. It sounds like you've used overseer a lot, and that you, and perhaps I'm putting words in your mouth, but you quite like it.
I think it's a very good tool to be able to take account of multiple factors on a farm to give you an idea of where risk is on the farm, to then create the discussion with a farmer as to how we attempt to manage that risk. And often it's a very, it's an eye-opener to a farmer as to where the risk at block level is on their farms, and once they realise that, they, and often it's not just the risk, it's the opportunity loss or over expenditure that they put into their farm system when they realise they could do it more efficiently to become more efficient and as a result be better on the environment. So I do like the tool. As we've said, the there is variation, sources of error, and probably is normally about 20% error plus or minus. But in terms of allowing a farmer to assess blocks to see where their risk is on their farm and what's contributing to that, what is the driver of that risk, is a really good tool as that as a decision making tool on farm.
Would you rather see it still in PC1 or grudgingly accept that perhaps the nitrogen risk scorecard is a better way to go?
In terms of, as being talked about today, being able to truly be able to have complex input, at the moment there's nothing that allows us to do that. The limitations of the scorecard or the drafting gates are just one parameter. So we're not looking at nitrogen and just inputs, or we're just looking at the stocking rate. So in terms of truly reflecting, it's obvious downside is, in essence, it's still only looking at nitrogen. And there is a cost to that, for the budgets that I've done in preparation for NNLRs all the Waikato back in 2018-19. I would say for an average dry stock farm, that was a $1,800 to $3,000 exercise, and for a dairy farm, this is for 2 years of budgets, because at that point we needed 2 years of budgets, and for a dairy farm, you were $2,500 to $4,000 in time spent to collect the data, analyse it, do the GIS, and input that data to the rules, review it, present it to the farmer.
Alright, okay, changing tack completely. I want to just tease out from you and about overland flow. So overland flow is obviously the vector by which contaminants are consumed, suspended sediments, phosphorus, and fecal coliforms get into the stream, and with all the consequential effects downstream that we're concerned about. So at least in terms of those three components, overland flow, or the generation of overland flow on slopes, is the thing that we're trying to avoid or manage. Previous lives of mine, I've been involved in a bit of that work, but not in the sort of climatic environments that you're dealing with here. More semi-arid environments where there's much more limited vegetation cover and overland flow happens very rapidly when there's a rainfall on any slope, be it flat or sloping. But I suspect that the situation is different here. Your observations, again, I understand from your background as you've been on the ground and got experience of observing the landscape and seeing these things occurring. I want to make sure my understanding of overland flow and where it occurs on a slope, when it occurs in relation to a rainfall event, what has been the factors involved in that.
are the same as yours. You talk about overland flow. I have an understanding of what overland flow means to me. What does it mean to you? Can you give me a bit more of a...
So for me, that overland flow is the short-term movement of due to a weather event, and so it's really important what the... So for me, there's two types of overland flow. There's the very specific where all water is travelling into one place to create a channel to then to go to a receiving environment. But I also see a lot of overland flow, which is across the whole area of the paddock. And this is the example where I talked about with the paddock where the farmer had domed the paddock. And even though there was only probably a 1 metre fall across 50 metres, in the direct vicinity of the waterway, there will still be movement of water when you get 30 mils of rain in an hour, which has become more and more common from the outside 3 to 5 metres of that paddock into the watercourse. And that's why the idea of a wide setback really appeals to me, because I see it in practice so much that even something in a rule that we consider to be 0 to 7 degrees, which is considered as flat land, there is still significant runoff risk.
That's a really good example, because it gets to the sort of the part of the understanding that I have of how overland flow occurs. So there's a situation where the rainfall rate exceeds the infiltration rate on the soil. So the amount of rain coming down is faster than the soil can soak it up. But in the semi-arid environment that I'm familiar with, the such soil as is there has very low infiltration rate, and so you very quickly get to a point where...
Yeah.
But in the better soil conditions and more humid environments that we have here, it's actually quite a reasonable rainfall rate that you get to before that infiltration rate is exceeded on the soil. So then there's a pathway that the water can get to the channel and be infiltrated into the soil and go through the soil profile and then emerge at the surface close to the channel and make its way into the channel. Now that water has gone through the soil. It's not bringing with it fecal coliforms and things like that, or soil particles. But it is still overland flow quite close to the channel, but it's not, I would suggest, not particularly dangerous overland flow in terms of contaminant. But the overland flow where the rainfall exceeds the infiltration rate, you get overland flow.
Yeah.
So the situation you were describing on the domed paddock, where the overland flow is occurring close, on the slope of the dome, close to the channel, is that coming from infiltration excess, your rainfall rate excess, or is it coming from subsurface flow, where the rainfall is falling up here on the dome and pushing the water through the soil profile?
From the infiltrator, yeah. So that short term, just more rain than what
it sends a pulse through that emerges close to the stream.
No situations on the flat land, it obviously is influenced by water table. So, at that time of the year, the water table is very high, and we often see on the flat land that the drains are fairly full. There could be, your scenario could come into play as well, definitely.
Yeah, it's just that I'm teasing out that there are different sorts of overland flow,
yeah.
And the sort that we're discussing here is probably not as problematic and may not need as much mitigation as the overland flow, which is to do with the rainfall rate exceeding the soil infiltration.
I suppose the other consideration for me with the overland flow is that accumulative effect that when that small fingers of overland flow come together and then become an ephemeral or intermittent, that water can cause damage in velocity and moving down, and I'm thinking more, not necessarily on a paddock, but moving down at a race of a property, you know, the scouring out of a race where stock have walked, defecated and urinated, and how do we manage those short term. So then that comes back to the critical source areas within a farm that are there because of overland flow events.
And in terms of, I think critical source areas, that's a really important concept. I asked a question, perhaps of the previous witness, about how do you on the ground tell the difference between an ephemeral and an intermittent stream? There's a certain amount of skill involved in the same context, you know, identifying critical source areas and being able to manage those. That's not for amateurs.
Not a ship required, but we've got an opportunity to give farmers a better understanding of what's that like. And for example, large farmers are approaching 7 farms, so if farm guide plans and went around with the overseer for 2 days assessing the farms, and the one you can see the excitement in his face afterwards when he said to me, he goes, "For all the years I've been trying to speed up water to get to my waterways, you're actually telling me I need to slow it down." And he was so excited that it made the connection of what that meant to the environment. The fact that by just a few simple cutouts, putting it back into the paddock to get it off the race was going to have such a difference to water quality. But he's never had to consider it before. His consideration was, how can I get my cows to the shed quicker, so I don't want them walking above them. I don't want them to walk through puddles.
So in your experience of people like yourself, the sort of the farmer, loosely speaking, farm advisor role, is that sort of knowledge widespread and can be delivered to the stakeholders relatively easily?
Yeah, if I compare that to when we did, you mentioned yesterday about sustainable milk plans, and I project managed that project, and we were all on a learning journey back then, and that was 10 plus years ago. But you talk to those same consultants now, and they've got that same passion and understanding of how can we make things better. So I think there's been, in the last 10 years, a real shift in the knowledge of agricultural consultants around the importance and the mitigations that are available for environmental protection.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Hodges.
Thank you, Your Honour. You'll be pleased, Mr. Brockstock, but I don't have the same number of questions. Coming to the nitrogen risk scorecard, do you think that the risk score that comes out of it provides a sound basis for comparing the relative risk between different dairy farm operations?
In terms of the risk relative to management inputs, yes. My understanding is there's a very large data set behind there. Now, the robustness of that data set in terms of how it was collected, I think we're not being privy to that, but I understand that Ontario has a very good process in place. But in terms of that, the size of that data set to be able to take the outliers out where the data is inaccurate to provide those data sets, I would say it's pretty good. It covers, from my assessment, the main management activities that you would expect on a dairy farm that would influence nitrogen in circulating in the system, whether above ground or potentially low ground. So in terms of being able to use that as a comparison, I said, but directly relating that number to what's going to be my leaching loss, it's still a proxy for that.
Yeah. But in terms of the management aspects of it, it is a means of
comparison. Yeah, it covers all the main things you would expect it to cover.
Okay. And the other thing, in terms of the ability to just monitor whether nitrogen use is going up or down, does it provide an appropriate tool for doing that? Like, say if you do a risk scorecard today, you do a scorecard in 2 years' time, would you feel comfortable that it is reliable in terms of telling you that the likely risk of the nitrogen getting out of the farm?
If you interrogated the data, it would be able to give you an accurate picture of where inputs are increasing on that farm, leading to a higher nitrogen risk of scorecard number. But that number is still only on an annual basis,
yes.
So it doesn't break it down monthly basis or where on the farm that risk is increasing.
Could overseer deal with the temporal aspect of it?
Yes.
I thought it was based on long-term data.
Oh, it's based on long-term data, but it will take into account climate, but using the long-term data, whereas the scorecard doesn't have the ability to do that. You can infer things as a result to say, well, if this farm is in a certain catchment, I know what the temporal conditions are for that farm. But the limitations of both of those, both the scorecard and the overseer, is as the overseer does work on long-term data, if you, for example, have a drought and then you find yourself bringing in more supplements and putting more nitrogen on when the conditions are conducive to putting nitrogen on to produce the same amount of milk as what you would in a normal year where you put less nitrogen on and use less supplement just purely on the fact that you have better growth conditions, by default, overseer assumes that you've become an inefficient farmer because of increased nitrogen risk, because it's using long-term data, not taking into account that actually you have that year you have 200 mils less of rain compared to the other year, and that's one of the downsides of overseer. But that helps to provide a direct comparison year on year, because as you can understand, by just changing the rainfall by 200 mils on any overseer file could change your risk, and all of a sudden we've got no confidence in the output because someone decided to, they could change the number very easily.
What you're really saying is we're not working in a perfect world in terms of understanding what happens to nitrogen and other contaminants.
That's true.
Okay, thank you. In terms of the risk scorecard, does not the risk score address the creep issue that you were concerned about, rather than having to rely on the nitrogen surplus figure?
If the scorecard was going to be produced on an annual basis and made available, in theory, the inputs required to calculate the M-farm surplus are all in the nitrogen scorecard anyway.
Yeah.
So it should be an automatic process. You should pretty much be able to receive, once you've inputted the data, an N-risk scorecard number and your M-farm surplus at the same time.
Yeah. It's not a big deal.
It should be the same process.
Okay. Thank you. You're concerned about equity between dairy and dry stock and a farmer looking over the fence. Do you consider that's been partly addressed by the stock exclusion regulations and the Freshwater Farm Plan regulation? Is it leveling up the playing field?
I think yes, in terms of it's a number of things. I think that the schedules are really good for that because it puts us all on a level playing field as to how we need to assess our farming operation. And in terms of having a regime where as you increase intensity you have greater oversight, it improves that as well. But we have an understanding, and I think from everybody, that generally risk in terms of nitrogen from a dairy farm is 2 to 3 times higher generally than a dry stock property. But the where it, obviously, because we're using a scorecard as a proxy, where we fall down is that is would compare directly the risks of those other contaminants and the actions that are required to reduce those contaminants.
I understand those aspects. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was thinking more of if both types of farming are required to fence certain streams, fence wetlands, does that level off the playing field?
Yeah. For me, it comes down to that risk on a one-hectare basis of any bit of land, whether it be a car park, a dairy farm, an arable farm. That 1 hectare of land has got an ability to impact on water quality. So we should, to a certain extent, consider that, but we will need to be doing a bit on the little parcels of land that we've got.
Okay. There are interesting views on the proposed change from 15 degrees to 10 degrees of slope. If the court was to decide that the 15 degrees was to remain, would it not be possible for the council to develop a tool, say over a 5-year period, to address that slope issue? Would that be possible? So if you said that for the first 5 years you can 10 degrees is the rule, but after that 15 years once the proper tool is available?
Yeah. I think a number of things that I consider is, we know there's, if we went straight to a 15 rule, the amount of fencing that would come out of that as a result of your first environment plan or your first assessment would be so big, as my concerns are similar to yours, is that if we overwhelm farmers too much, they will just turn off totally. So to have a staged approach to say, let's go to 10, and then that's potentially move 15 at a later date, and that gives more time to obviously refine the definitions of what's going to be in and out, and let us focus on those, what's considered to probably be contributing more higher risk areas.
And you've learned from experience in that first period as well, and so there's a number of sort of benefits in some kind of staged approach. One of the things I've never really figured out, even though I've been involved in quite a few of these cases, is how are wintered off cattle and dairy support cattle accommodated in nitrogen budgets for a catchment?
Using the nitrogen risk scorecard, they're not, or unless those numbers those cows that are wintered off were on the dry stock farm during the period that the calculation was made. That's where overseer would be beneficial, because if we're all doing overseers for a certain year and overseer looks over a 12-month period, those stock will be picked up for the period that they're on the dairy farm and then for the period that they're on the dry stock farm. So that's one of the benefits of overseer, is nothing can be missed by some dates.
If they're wintered off in a, say 10 kilometres or 20 kilometres away, surely that would affect the inherent risks of that alternative site compared to the home site, for example.
Yeah.
So there's issues with both systems, aren't there?
Yeah, definitely. You could say we're transferring the problem to just somewhere else within the catchment or out of the catchment for a short period of time. So definitely, where you're putting them at that period of time puts pressure on that system, but that farmer will have, he knows he's got those stock coming, so he'll have a stocking rate appropriate to accommodate them, so it's not additional to what he's already doing, it's part of his normal, this is my farming system.
So do you have a brilliant suggestion as to how the court could satisfy itself that issue was being addressed with a nitrogen risk scorecard?
I'd have to have more of a think on it as to how that would work, but my initial reaction would be the scorecard would probably have to become a lot more complex to be able to have a better indication of, because the scorecard is on a 12 monthly period, how much fertilizer you're using over 12 months, how much. It does take into account risk in terms of when you apply things, but and it does take into account if those stock are going off in terms of you get less points or more points according to your practices, but it doesn't take into account the impact on the other five at all. And stocking rate doesn't, it's not picked up in our stocking rate rule in terms of the dates that you calculate where you are in terms of stocking rate.
Okay, thank you, that's helpful. Just as a general question, you may not be able to answer this very general question. In terms of the effects of off-site wintergrass, is that a significant component of the total nitrogen risk compared to the rest of the farm operations?
I'm probably not able to comment because, again, in my experience of using IUCN where we can model it, it's still only models, the output is only still on a yearly basis. So if there was an elevation, you wouldn't see it in Overseer. Whereas if we said it was a crop, you would see the elevation because you could put it as a crop. Or if they were just on a crop on one book of a farm, not rotating around the dry stock farm, you could do it that way. As long as no other stock went on that block that you might work on Overseer. So you could see it that way. But logic would say is that you put in that, like, you're moving cows across onto a farm that they're urinating, defecating in a period where the pasture uptake is probably less because we're in the winter period. So there is a higher potential risk as a result of that.
Okay, so you don't have a feel that if a farm wintered off, a farm that didn't and everything else was equal, there'd be a 10% reduction in nitrate leaching because of the wintering off component. You've got
to feel for that. I need to
think about it.
Model some, because with the changing of the rules of Overseer, we don't seem to be doing so many Overseers of late, so to have those numbers running around in my head as to what you'd expect to see.
No, I can understand.
It
was a helpful question. And just one thing I noticed through reading the evidence is there's about three different definitions of stocking used by different people. I understand that the PC1 definition is based on Overseer figures, and farmers are most used to using MAF type figures or something like that. Is there a generally agreed stocking unit way of classifying stocking units that should be used in PC1?
Yeah, so there's been a bit of confusion. So the numbers that are used in PC1 at the moment were taken from the values that were used in PC10 in the Rotorua Lakes catchment, which was an amalgamation of the standard way of stock units, is used by beef and lamb, plus some additional definitions derived from Overseer. So it was a bit of a mix, and that's caused a lot of confusion. Through the Joint Witness statements, by taking away some of the definitions and focusing on the stock unit and the description of the stock type was agreed would take away a lot of that confusion that the original decisions version caused.
So it is an issue, basically, what you're saying.
Yeah, it's been an issue that in the time I've been involved comes up at most conversations.
Okay. Well, it's helpful to know there's an issue that's got to be solved. At least that's a starting point. Thank you. And just one last question, and it relates to schedules D1 and D2. One of the things that I'm always concerned about is practicability, understandability, and avoiding confusion. In their present form, do you think the schedules achieve those 2 points? Or would there be any benefit in looking at trying to rationalise them a little bit more to ensure consistency between the new regulations and the added requirements of PC1?
I think the consistency with new regulations is really important, and that's where, if we take the example of the setback, new regulations talk of a 3 metre setback. Minimum and fencing up to 0 to 5 degrees. So could have the potential, and how this lands at the moment, we've got suggested a 3 metre setback, a minimum, but that suggested there's been a 3 metre average. So we could have a situation that on a farmer's trying to implement two sets of rules for three for setbacks on 0 to 5, then 5 to 10, and 10 to 15, which could become very confusing for him. And that's one of my rationale for having that a same setback rule as the national regulations, because then that's easy for a farmer. I know I need to be at 3 metres, and I need to go a bit more to go around an obstacle or be able to put my fence in the right place. I can do that, and I understand the concerns of, well, that means I may lose some pasture, but I always come back every time is look at what we're trying to achieve with the fencing. Like, what are the risks to the waterway, bank stabilisation, riparian planting, building a biodiversity or a habitat for Mahina Kai. Work out what's best for that, and you will often find that you're at 3 metres anyway.
Okay, thanks. And in terms of the readability of the schedules at the moment for a farmer looking at them for the first time, would they be able to understand it easily, or would they need to have professional advice? Or?
I think for a farmer in layman terms, there would need to be good guidance notes that put it into farmer layman's terms. But I understand schedules, rules, etc. do need to be written in a certain way so they can be implementable.
Mm.
But we need to have, especially if for the rules for low intensity, where potentially the farmer will not need, or the landowner will not need to use a consultant, that's where it's really important. It's got to be understandable so they can look at this themselves and meet their obligations and understand what they need to do and why they need to do it.
Thank you very much. Once again, your evidence has been very helpful.
Thank you. I've just got a few questions. I understand from a number of your answers to a number of questions that rather than focus on a particular number or even a particular set of numbers in your business, you're looking at trends, and presumably in terms of assisting farmers with their operations, you're looking at things like productivity trends or cost trends. Is that right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that models which quantify things can do is they can spit out numbers that people can latch on to and can say, well, there's a number, 123 or 111 or whatever it may be. And I just wonder to what extent, if we pull back from the exercise that's led to that number being spat out, whether that might be an illusion of precision in terms of that number when you actually step back and say, well, what's happening in the catchment?
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Right. And so you would say, let's look at the trends, and presumably we can do two things if we look at the overall trends, or the trends within a catchment, for example. Firstly, we can say, are we going in the right direction to achieve the objectives of PC1 or whatever the control is that we're trying to achieve? You need to speak, I'm sorry.
Yes.
And the second thing is, and while we're doing that, presumably, by working on the trends, there's a degree at least to which the fairness of the operation, the fairness of the exercise across the catchment, can be generally maintained. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
In other words, for every farmer, we don't say, do you hit this number or not? Are you headed in the same direction as your neighbours? And that may well be something where a farmer looks over the fence and accepts that my neighbour's got a different system, but nonetheless I can see that they're doing something which will mean that the whole catchment is doing better. Right, okay. I just wonder in that circumstance where you're concerned about the use of, say, overseer or anything else, because, you know, the thing about Overseer is it's been worked on for so long and it provides us with a degree of comprehensiveness, which obviously is quite valuable. You undertake one exercise in terms of building an Overseer file for a property, and that gives you a whole lot of information that you can then use, right?
Yes.
Yes. But I just wonder, is there a risk that you're trying to have a Swiss Army knife as your tool, rather than saying, actually, for nitrogen, we need something which is different from pathogens? Is that fair?
Yes, and unfortunately, we don't have anything for pathogens.
I know.
And that's where, you know, the farm environment plans and those processes try to cover all those things. Yeah, if we could have an Overseer equivalent for all the others, it would be great.
Sure. Or a scorecard for all the others.
Yes, yes.
Or possibly four separate scorecards.
Yeah.
I mean, the farm environment plans, presumably, because they have to be drafted with the four contaminants in mind, you and your peers in the field of farm consultancy would be able to say, exactly as you've said to us in evidence, on your farm, you should look at this, because you've got this particular situation here. You're on a point along the particular stream that's a tributary of the Waipa or the Waikato, and you need to address this in this way. Is that what you're about?
And that's where I see the freshwater farm plans in terms of CCCB
coming in
to turn, slightly change around how we've been farm planning in the past from good practice expectations to what do we actually need for the attachment, and work it that way. And that hopefully will change the way that we look at the reason why we're doing something. It's not just a filler rule, it's actually because the purpose is we want to improve water quality or to meet the objectives.
And again, that would be something where every farmer can look over the fence and say, is my neighbour working in the same direction with their own farm environment plan or their own freshwater farm plan?
Yeah.
Right. So, while we've got a particular focus here in PC1 on some particular issues, from your point of view, when you're actually going on to the farm to advise the farmer, you need to integrate a range of other things that are going on as well for that operation.
Yeah, definitely.
And so when we talk about the practicability of all of these things, and there's a whole lot of stuff around technical feasibility, but to my way of thinking, practicability also means how much will it cost and how long will it take the person who actually has to do the work to do it? And sometimes time and cost are actually quite closely related. Is that fair?
Yes.
And you obviously are an advocate for the extent to which, if I can call it, self-interest of the farmer can be brought to bear to encourage compliance.
It needs to be front and central to give them an understanding as to why we're doing things and to look at that bigger picture. And as soon as a farmer gets to that and the bigger picture, their interaction into a farm environment planning process totally changes.
Right. And to some extent, from a regulator's point of view, they might say, well, that becomes self-policing because the farmer sees that incentive and says, well, I should do this for my own good. All right. Thank you very much. Is there anything arising out of the court's questions, Mr. Minhoek?
Thank you. Just one matter, Mr. Boxoff. There was one answer you gave to an answer to a question by Commissioner Mabin regarding the benefits of or the insights available through going through the Overseer process, and you also talked to the cost of that process. So first clarification, I think you mentioned the $1,800 to $3,000 cost of that process. By comparison, for the nitrogen risk scorecard, the farmer could undertake that themselves, and so there wouldn't be that cost. Is that correct?
Yes, the theory that I assume will work is that the report they put their own data in, and that portal will then generate an output.
And on the benefits of the overseer process, you talked about the insights that a farmer could derive as far as, if you call it, the risks and opportunities that there might be. Would those, you talked about that as a benefit of overseer, but is that equally a benefit of going through the nitrogen risk scorecard process?
The on assessment of the scorecard, there is benefits of not focusing on the whole number and focusing on the individual its parts, and I see that of real value as well. The only downside is that it's at a whole farm level, and you can't break it down to my hill country versus my flats versus my influence area. We can do effluent to a certain extent, so it's still it can achieve those things, but not to the same degree of how far you can dive into it.
Certainly, and final clarification, as far as the comment you made in response to a question from His Honour in relation to the farmer buy-in and the self-interest aspect, again, given that farmers would be able to use the nitrogen risk scorecard themselves, that provides a greater opportunity for that as well. Would you agree?
Yeah, it does provide opportunity. What I would say is with support from whether it be a milk supply company or Dairy NZ or Beef and Lamb, because that's when we get the value, when they've got that ability to interrogate. And in the past, all milk supply companies are very good at that. When a scorecard number or an overseer has been reported as regards national regulations, that they'll run events, know your number, and where there's an ability to meet with consultants, go through some scenarios, learn as to why my number is what it is and what should I be looking for. So the industry is really good at that, both dairy and beef and lamb, and I've not had the experience in horticulture and arable, but I'm sure they have similar processes for helping their farmers to upskill and make decisions on farm decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. I've no further questions.
Any other questions? No, very good. Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Brockford, for your excuse. We might take the break now, rather than bring somebody on just to take a break for lunch, and then return at, say, 2:10 for your next witness, who is, I assume,
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Smith, very good. Thank you.